Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Faded Tales. This is the podcast where we wander through the stories of animals whose futures have faded and the quiet, determined work to bring them back. I'm your host, Zoya, and if you're new here, we talk about all endangered animals, sometimes extinct ones too. Now, today, we drift to the edge of the Pacific, where kelp forests sway and green cathedrals and sunlight to rips across the water. If you look closely among the tangles of golden kelp, you might see a small face, dark eyes, whiskered and curious. It floats on its back, paws tucked into its chest as if it's in a state of meditation. This is the sea otter, one of the smallest marine mammals on Earth and one of the most extraordinary. Sea otter story is one of extremes. Once there were hundreds of thousands of them stretching from Japan to California, thriving, curious, alive. Then, in less than a century, humans nearly erased them from the oceans. Today, they've clawed their way back, not everywhere, not completely, but enough to remind us that survival is sometimes the most beautiful rebellion of all. So, let's settle in, let's drift in with the tide for a while, through fur and foam, through history and hope, and meet the creatures, the creature that saved the ocean. And also, if you guys want to listen to this in the background, it's fine. If you want to learn more about animal facts, it's fine. Everyone's welcome. So sit back, relax, sip your cup of tea. Let's get into the story of the sea otter. All right, everyone. Welcome. This is Faded Tales for you. And today I've got a long one for you guys. So welcome to the sea otter. If you've ever seen a sea otter in person, you probably notice two things first. Their size, smaller than you expect for a marine mammal, and their fur. The fur is the reason they're here, and the reason they almost weren't. Most marine mammals, like seals and whales, rely on thick layers of fat called blubber to keep them warm. But sea otters? They have none. Instead, they wear the densest fur in the animal kingdom. A single square inch of otter's coat can hold up to a million hairs. Imagine the density of an entire head of human hair packed into a postage stamp. Each strand traps air close to their skin, creating a barrier of warmth against the cold Pacific. But that also means grooming isn't just vanity, it's survival. An otter spends nearly half its day cleaning, fluffing, and combing every patch of fur, ensuring no bit is matted or wet. If they fail, the cold seeps in fast. Now, when you think of the word adaptation, it might bring to mind evolution's quiet patience. The sea otter is a masterclass in it. Its body is sleek yet buoyant, perfectly tuned for a life spent at the surface. Its lungs are oversized relative to its body, letting it float effortlessly. And when it dives, those same lungs collapse partially to resist the crushing pressures below. Their paws are surprisingly human-like, nimble, capable of gripping shells, prying open clams, and even using tools. Sea otters were one of the first non-human species observed using objects as tools, a sign of cognitive flexibility. A rock held on their chest becomes a dinner plate or an anvil. They strike a clam or sea urchin against it until it opens, then eat delicately, often while drifting on their backs in the sun. Beneath their gentle appearance, their teeth are razor sharp, their metabolism ferocious. A sea otter might eat up to a quarter of its body weight each day just to survive the cold. That's the equivalent of a 150-pound human eating around 35 pounds of food daily. They hunt constantly, diving down to the seafloor for crabs, snails, or urchins, surfacing to crack and devour their catch. Every movement is efficient, precise, it's like watching evolution solve a puzzle in real time. When morning light hits the Pacific, you can often see them floating together, a cluster of shapes among the kelp. These groups are called rafts. Sometimes it's just a few otters. Sometimes it's hundreds. Within a raft, you can sense their rhythms. Mothers grooming pups, others sleeping, paws intertwined so they don't drift apart. They wrap themselves in kelp to anchor against the current, as if tucking into a blanket. There's something strangely human about the sight, a tenderness in the way they rest together, a kind of quiet trust. And it's not just our projection. Sea otters form real special bonds. They're one of the few non-primate species to show clear signs of individual relationships, like, for example, play, grooming, and even jealousy. Male and female otters live slightly different lives. Females tend to be more social, often forming small groups with pups or other mothers. Males, especially dominant ones, maintain territories and patrol coastal sections. And at the center of otter society, the mothers. A mother sea otter is fiercely devoted from the moment her pup is born. She rarely lets it leave her chest. A pup, fluffy and light, can't dive yet, so it floats, a little bundle of fur that must be consistently dried, warmed, and fed. The mother grooms it for hours, blowing air into the coat to keep it buoyant. When she dives for food, she wraps the pup in kelp to keep it from drifting away. Sometimes, when food is scarce or the ocean's rough, you can sense the exhaustion. Researchers have described mothers sleeping only minutes at a time, their fur-worn fin, their ribs showing. They give everything, quite literally everything, to raise their pup to independence. And yet, even this struggle, they play. Otters tumble, roll, and chase each other through the kelp forest. They juggle rocks or bits of shells, behavior once thought to be random, but now believed to be a practice or maybe even joy. One researcher described it best. Watching otters is like watching the ocean's laughter. So cute. It's tempting to see sea otters as endlessly cheerful. The smiling faces, the playful gestures, but it's like all animals, their emotional lives are more complex. They experience stress, competition, and even grief. In captivity, otters have been observed mourning their lost companions. In the wild, mothers have been seen carrying stillborn pups for days, reluctant to let go. It's a heartbreaking sight, and a reminder that emotional connection is not uniquely human. At the same time, they're problem solvers. Studies have shown that individual otters remember how to use tools and can even teach the behavior. In California, researchers followed one famous sea otter named Tula. She had been rescued after an oil spill and could no longer survive in the wild. But in rehabilitation, she began caring for orphan pups. Her nurturing instincts were so strong that she became a surrogate mother to over a dozen pups who went on to live in the wild. Her legacy helped spark modern sea otter rehabilitation programs, and in a way, she became the mother of a generation. Through individuals like Tula, we can see how intelligence and empathy intertwine, not as accidents of evolution, but as tools for survival. The life of a sea otter follows the ocean's pulse. At dawn, they groom and feed. At midday, they eat and they rest in bellies to the sky. At dusk, they dive again, searching the seafloor for the next meal. There's a quiet poetry in their schedule, a loop that never breaks, only shifts with the current. It's this consistency that gives them stability, and what makes their sudden disappearance from much of the Pacific so devastating. Because of every kelp bed that once shimmered with otters are now empty waters, and stories waiting to be remembered. Next, I will explore what happens when an animal so small can shape an entire ecosystem and how removing it nearly destroyed a world beneath the waves. To understand the sea otter's true importance, you have to look beyond its soft fur and playful grace. You have to look underwater. Among the kelp forests is where the real story unfolds. Imagine diving below the waves off the coast of California or British Columbia. The water is cold, but light streams through a canopy of swaying kelp that rises like underwater trees. Fish start below between the leaves. Crabs scuttle along the bottom, and it feels alive, intricate, balanced, and a little fragile. These kelp forests are among the most productive ecosystems on Earth. They provide shelter for countless species from abalone and to seals, and act as powerful carbon sinks, pulling carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing it deep beneath the sea. But there's a secret to their survival. Without sea otters, these forests vanish. The villain in the story, if you could call it that, is the sea urchin. A small spiny creature that feeds on the holdfast of kelp, the very anchors that keep the plants rooted to the ocean floor. Left unchecked, urchins multiply rapidly and mold out entire kelp beds, turning lush forests into barren wastelands known as urchin barrens. Enter the sea otter, the keystone species. And if you guys don't know what it is, I mentioned it earlier in my podcast from when I first started. A keystone species is one that holds the ecosystem together, like the central stone in an arch. Remove it and everything collapses. Otters are relentless urchin hunters. They dive repeatedly, sometimes hundreds of times a day, prying the spiny shells from the rocks and devouring them with practiced ease. They keep the urchin population in check, allowing the kelp to regrow and thrive. In turn, the kelp shelters fish. Fish absorb carbon and calms the coastal waves. It's an elegant loop, a circle of balance that depends entirely on one small, hungry mammal. When sea otters were nearly hunted to extinction, that loop broke. Without them, urchins exploded in numbers, kelp forests vanished, and with them went countless species that depended on that habitat. The coastlines grew quieter, emptier, ecosystems unraveling in slow motion. The loss of the otters didn't just remove a predator, it erased an entire way that the ocean breathes. Now, scientists were studying California coast noticed something fascinating in the 1970s. This is the full story I'm going to give you guys. When small populations of otters began to recover, in places where otters returned, kelp forests follow. And with kelp came fish, invertebrates, seabirds, even improved water quality. One study found that the presence of otters increased the overall biodiversity of kelp ecosystems by as much as 40%. Another revealed that the kelp forests where otters thrive can capture and store 10 times more carbon than areas without them. The sea otter's appetite, it turns out, fuels a kind of ecological healing. Every clam cracked and urchin eaten keeps the oceans in rhythm, as I've said before. And the quiet genius of nature's design, even the smallest actors can have largest influence. But the balance they maintain today is fragile, one built on recovery, not stability. And to understand why, we need to turn back time to when the sea otter wasn't a symbol of conservation, but of commerce. The story of the sea otter, there's a near extinction, begins with its fur, the very thing that kept it alive. In the late 18th century, when European and Russian explorers pushed it into the North Pacific, they found something more valuable than gold. It's otter pellets. Otter pelts, which is like the fur. So dense, so soft, and so rare that they could fetch fortunes in the fur markets of China and Europe. A single pelt could be traded for an entire shipload of goods. And so began the Great Fur Rush, a frenzy of hunting that stretched from Japan and Russia's Kuril Islands across Alaska, down through British Columbia, and as far south as California. In 1740, Russian traders were already setting up camps along the Aleutian Islands, forcing indigenous allude to communities to hunt sea otters under brutal conditions. Entire coastal populations were enslaved or displaced in the pursuit of fur. The sea otter, once abundant, began to vanish from the from region after region. By the 1800s, the species had almost completely eradicated from the South Pacific. In less than a century, human desire for luxury had silenced thousands of miles of coastline. It's estimated that before the fur trade, there were between 150,000 and 300,000 sea otters across their range. By 1911, fewer than 2,000 remained. That year, international outrage finally led to the North Pacific Fur Seal Treaty, one of the first multinational conservation agreements. It included that sea otters under its protection, but for many regions, it was already too late. Populations in Japan, Alaska, and California had been completely wiped out. Only small scattered groups survived in remote areas, tiny lifeboats of a species drifting in the vast emptied sea. Long before European ships arrived, coastal indigenous peoples, including the Aleut, Haida, Nuchanulf, and the Kumash, lived along sea. I'm so sorry for butchering those pronunciations. For them, otters were never just resources. They were kin spirits and symbols of balance. Many indigenous languages have ancient words for the sea otter that translate roughly to the old man of the sea and or the keeper of warmth. Their relationship was one of respect and reciprocity. Otters were hunted occasionally, but sustainably. Their pelt used for ceremonial robes, their presence tied to ecological understanding. When colonizers arrived, the balance shattered. Indigenous people were often coerced or enslaved to hunt otters for European markets. Communities that had once lived in harmony with the ocean were now forced to destroy it. And in the process, something deeper was lost, a philosophy that saw humans not as rulers of the sea, but participants within it. Today, many indigenous nations are leading sea otter conservation efforts again, reclaiming both stewardship and story. They understand, as their ancestors did, that protecting otters meant protecting the entire coastal world. Now, for decades, scientists assumed the sea otters were extinct in California. Then in 1938, a group of biologists surveying Big Sur made a startling discovery. Among the rocky cliffs and kelp beds of Bixby Creek, they spotted a small raft of otters, about 50 individuals. No one knew exactly how they survived. Some believe they hid in remote coves. Others say they persisted in deeper waters, unseen. But somehow, against all odds, they endured. That remnant population became the seed of California's recovery. From these 50 otters, today's population is of over 3,000 descendants. It's one of the most remarkable wildlife comebacks in history, but also one of the most fragile. Because even now, the ghost of the fur trade lingers. Sea otters have not reclaimed most of their historic range. Large gaps remain, especially along the Oregon and Washington coasts, where they're still absent. And in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, where they once numbered in the tens of thousands, their populations have plummeted again, this time not from hunting, but from ecological disruption and predation. By orcas. The story of sea otters reminds us that extinction isn't always a single moment, and sometimes it's a slow unraveling long after the guns stop firing. The ocean still bears the scars. Kelp forests gone, urchins barrens spreading, as species that once relied on the balance struggling to adapt. Even the cultural memory of sea otter faded. In many coastal communities, generations grew up without even seeing one. only hearing stories from elders who remember their grandparents speaking of them. It's strange to think that such an expensive, visible creature could disappear so quietly. No fanfare, no awareness, just absence. That's why Faded Tales is really about, to be honest. This is why I made it. It's like the way, like species, it's like way to tell stories. Like, it's weird, like, so they don't just stay vanished, but they're in your imagination. That's what I really want. But this isn't where the story ends, though. In fact, there's a tide that begins to turn, where science, compassion, and persistence start to rebuild what was lost. So that is what I'm going to speak about next. Now, when an animal begins to return from the edge, the world around it, it must also learn to adapt. That's the paradox of recovery. Nature can heal, but the process of healing changes everything. For the sea otter, that story begins in the middle of the 20th century, when scientists, activists, and communities decided that extinction was an acceptable ending. Never is. After the discovery of the hidden California colony in 1938, protection efforts slowly began to take shape. By the 1960s and 70s, conservationists launched ambitious reintroduction programs, moving otters from surviving populations in Alaska and California to areas where they long been absent, Washington, British Columbia, even parts of the Aleutian chain. Each transfer was a gamble. Some succeeded, others failed, but every attempt carried hope. A belief that the ocean could remember what balance felt like. In Alaska, the reintroductions were remarkably successful. While populations were surged from just a few thousand in the 1950s to more than 100,000 by the 1980s, reclaiming bays and islands where otters hadn't been seen in over a century. In California, recovery was slower, limited to by the fragmented habitats, human disruption, and oil spills. Still, the small population near Big Sur grew steadily, inching north and south across the coast. Today, California's otters number in around the 3,000s. A shadow of their original abundance, but a testament to what protection can achieve. Each otter born is more than just another life. It's a continuation of a legacy that nearly ended. But the sea otter's survival is still a precarious one. Their dens for their greatest evolutionary triumph also makes them tragically vulnerable to one of the modern world's most persistent dangers. Oil spills. Oil destroys the insulating quality of their fur, matting it down and removing the tiny pockets of air that keep them warm. Even a small amount of oil on the coat can cause hypothermia within hours. During the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989, thousands of sea otters in Alaska's Prince William Sound perished. The images of silked dying otters became symbols of more of both environmental devastation and the cost of human error. And yet, amidst the tragedy, it was the otters who sparked widespread outrage and reform. Their suffering galvanized the public support for stronger environmental regulation, wildlife rescue programs, and oil spill response plans that still shape policies today. Beyond oil, other modern threats linger. Entanglement in fishing gear kills otters every year. Pollution and agricultural runoff contaminate their food, and coastal development fragments their habitats, cutting off access to vital kelp beds. Even disease plays a role. Parasites like Toxoplasma gondii, often traced to cat waste in urban runoff, can infect and kill otters along California shores. For a species so dependent on clean, balanced ecosystems, every ripple of human activity sends a wave through their world. As sea otters reclaim parts of their range, not everyone has welcomed them. Fishermen in Alaska and British Columbia have voiced frustration over a competition for shellfish, crabs, clams, and urchins that form a vital part in local economies. From their perspective, the otter's comeback has also meant human loss. It's a complicated conservation, one where both sides carry truth. The otter doesn't know it's competing with us, it's simply doing what it's evolved to do. And yet communities whose livelihood depend on the same waters feel the impact of its return. Some regions have explored a collaborative management where indigenous nations, scientists, and fishers work together to maintain ecological and an economic balance. It's not easy, but it's necessary. Because coexistence isn't about choosing one's life over another. It's about finding a rhythm where both can thrive. And perhaps it's in the shared space between people and otters, where in between people and otters lies a lesson about how conservation truly works. Not as a war between human and wild, but as a conversation, slow, imperfect, and ongoing. The sea otters have become powerful symbols in marine biology and conservation science. They're what ecologists call a I think it's centennial. It's when like something is like guarding something. Sorry. Centennial species, organisms whose health reflects the health of the ecosystem around them. It's also a keystone species. That's pretty, but it's different. This is the one who's, so in the, you might think, oh, it's the same as keystone species. It's not. This one, centennial species, is like organisms whose health reflect the health of the ecosystem around them, while the keystone species is someone whose livelihood helps maintain the ecosystem. So it's kind of different. So anyway, when otters are thriving, the ocean is usually thriving too. Studying them has been taught us invaluable lessons about how top predators shape environments, how biodiversity interlocks like a web, and how even small species can influence planetary processes like carbon storage. In Alaska, researchers found that kelp forests protected by otters absorb millions of tons of carbon dioxide, a natural defense against climate change. In California, otters' protection of kelp beds have restored coastal fish populations and stabilized shorelines against erosion. They remind us that conservation isn't just about saving one species. It's about weaving the entire fabric of an ecosystem. And yet, even as we celebrate their resilience, we also have to face the uncomfortable truth. The work is never finished. Recovery doesn't mean invincibility. It's because we're giving them another chance, and it means we're giving them another chance and another responsibility. It's fascinating how an animal can transform in our collective imagination. Once hunted to the brink of extinction, the sea otter has become a beloved icon for the Pacific tourists traveling to Monterey Bay and Alaska's coves just to catch a glimpse of them, floating, grooming, playing, all that. Children's books feature them as symbols of care and kindness. Conservation organizations use them as mascots for marine protection. But perhaps the most meaningful shift has come from the communities who have known them longest, indigenous peoples of the Pacific coast. In recent decades, many First Nations have led cultural and ecological restoration projects, advocating for the return of sea otters, not just as wildlife, but as relatives. They speak on the otter's reappearance as a restoration of reciprocity, a renewal of the relationships between land, sea, and people. When a species like the sea otter comes home, it doesn't just change the ocean, it changes us. It reminds us of what we lost and what we can still be repaired. If you see a sea otter long enough, you'll notice something meditative about the way it moves, the way it floats, completely at ease, trusting the ocean to hold it up. It's a kind of peace we rarely see, and maybe even envy. But the peace is earned. Every breath the otter takes, every dive, every grooming session is an act of survival in an unpredictable world. In that sense, the sea otter is a mirror for us. We too live between the tides, between danger and safety, consumption and care, loss and renewal. Well, and like the otter, we're learning slowly how to float again in the world we've changed. There's a quiet moment in many conservation stories when numbers start to rise, when populations rebound, and the headlines shift from endangered to recovering. But behind the moment is always a choice. Sometimes the deciding that a species was worth saving. The sea otter survival is not an accident. It's a result of decades of work by scientists, volunteers, indigenous stewards, and ordinary people who refuse to accept extinction as inevitable. Their work continues today, monitoring populations, rescuing stranded pups, restoring kelp beds, and teaching new generations to see the ocean not as a resource, but as a home. And while the sea otter's future is still uncertain, it's a story, often sometimes sometimes something powerful, proof that even when the tide seems irreversible, it can still be turned. Now, we're near the end, you guys, but the sea otter journey began in abundance. It descended into near silence and rose again. Through care and persistence, it's not a perfect recovery, but it's real, and it makes it sacred. When you stand on the rocky shore and see one drifting by, you're not just looking at an animal, you're seeing the living memory of an ecosystem that refused to forget itself. Perhaps that's what old faded tales really are. Reminders. That's what we harm, we can also heal. That what we silence, we can also help sing along. And within the gentle weight of sea otters' fur lies in the warmth of the entire ocean, still breathing and still forgiving. I'm Zoya, and this has been Faded Tales. Thank you for listening, and thank you for minding. See you all next week.